Shall we start? My name is Kate Pretty. I'm the university's Pro Vice Chancellor for International Strategy. We're making strategy on the hoof. Such a thing did not exist when our speaker was last talking to us here. International strategy, the university takes a very broad view of its reasons for international engagement. Firstly, of course, its history is international, and its current makeup is international, both at the student and the staff level. Secondly, its brand and reputation are internationally known, and its relationships are highly diverse, and they carry across overseas institutions, from schools and universities to industry and government. And thirdly, and increasingly, those staff and students have a passionate, often altruistic interest in international activity, often pro bono. We see it in the meetings of the Careers Service, where what are now called alternative careers are the most highly attended events. In the Humanitarian Center, in which I take a personal interest, having rehoused them. In curricula and courses in our formal education, in funding and support for informal education, and in the study of development for its own sake. We can map international activity in the volunteering survey undertaken by the Community Office, and the figures, when last mapped, show that 1 in 3 of students in this university volunteer, often overseas, and 1 in 4 of the university's staff. That's by far the highest number of the UK higher education sector. We can map it in the siphoning of money from industry and from philanthropy to support new projects. In doing this, we draw on years and years of experience, of knowledge accumulated over centuries, not consciously for the purposes of development, but which can now be harnessed if we have the will, and many of us have, to deal with the inequities implied by the word development, the inequities of poverty, of disease, of education, of safety, and by dealing with a shared problem, that of climate change. I am leery of pronouncing upon what I mean by international development. I was invited to do so for the publication that we're celebrating here tonight, and ran away from it, knowing that I'm always epistemological. There are things that Cambridge as an institution, Cambridge as a membership of students and staff working together, can do for a developing world and for developing better processes within it. Perhaps that will do for you tonight. But what I perceive is that this is not the university that Keith Hart left. That there are things that Cambridge as an institution, Cambridge as a membership of students and staff working together, can do for a developing world and for developing better processes within it. Perhaps that will do for you tonight. But what I perceive is that this is not the university that Keith Hart left in 1997. In introducing him, I should own to the fact that I've known him for many years. He's now titled Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Goldsmiths. He came to us today via Geneva from Paris. He was a former lecturer in social anthropology and director of the Center of African Studies here at Cambridge. He was also the first social scientist to be nominated and awarded a Pilkington Prize for teaching at Cambridge, something that he may have forgotten. He was a student here. He studied classics, he studied anthropology, and he knows about economics and philosophy and international development, and indeed talks about the history of social thought. Since we worked together, a great deal has changed in Cambridge. I know that I would have to persuade him of that, because he is conscious, I know, of the rigidity that sometimes seems to characterize us, particularly after 800 years. But I would argue to you that Cambridge is now more socially aware, more focused on its responsibilities beyond Cambridge, and more open to change. We're not particularly well set up for change, as Keith might comment, and it takes some time to turn an 800-year-old juggernaut round in order to focus on the things that perhaps obsess most of us today. But actually, its very nature, its immense structure, where every senior member is part of government, allows individuals to flourish and genius to be acknowledged and honoured and given space. The best things that come out of Cambridge come because actually they grow in the cracks of this huge carapace. And there is infinite chance for change and for development and for improvement for all of us. Keith, while he was here, taught many of us to think carefully about what we were doing, based on his own wider understanding of many of the philosophies that he professes. I hope tonight he feels that in coming back here to lecture here for about 12 years since he last spoke at St. John's, he will give us 12 years of distilled wisdom and tell us which way we should go forward without rubbishing us too much. Keith Hart.
I need to move. I can't stand behind that. I think I talk loud anyway, so. I'm going to talk tonight about development and Cambridge's contribution to it. And I'm going to take a historical approach, which is the foundation of my approach to these questions. Kate seemed to imagine that because I have a scurrilous disposition that I would use the opportunity to rubbish Cambridge, which I will to a certain extent. But what interests me far more about Cambridge is the potential for renewal and expansion and for innovation that has characterized its development for 800 years, and I want to talk about that. So my talk is in three parts. The first is on development, which I will argue that I have five different takes on what development might mean in this context, each one of them referring to a different historical period, but all of them relevant to us today. Then I'll talk about Cambridge. And finally, I'll try and bring these two things together in the third section, which will be briefer, to talk about what Cambridge might contribute to international development now. Now, for me, the first and dominant meaning of development, and certainly in the context of international development, is that it was the word that arose after the collapse of European empire, after the Second World War, after the anti-colonial revolution, which in my view is and was the most significant political movement of the 20th century. It was the word that arose to describe a post-colonial relationship between rich and poor countries. So, for me, development refers to a particular period in which there was the premise of rich countries helping poor countries to become richer in the aftermath of colonial empire. And I believe that this premise was seriously undertaken in what the French call les Trente Glorieuses, the three decades from 1945 to 1975, in which not only in the West did industrial societies commit themselves to an expansion of public services, a version, if you like, of social democracy, but also they were committed to the idea of the developmental state. In fact, until the early 70s, it was universally acknowledged that the only institution capable of lifting an economy systematically and effectively was the state. And this idea of a developmental state, which was universal, whether you were a Marxist or a Keynesian, began to unravel in the 1970s and, of course, was replaced by a market fundamentalism, which, as we know, held sway for three decades after that, from the 80s. Now, so my argument would be, first of all, that the premise, the political premise of development was based on an experience of sustained economic growth at the global level, which in turn was fueled by the leading industrial countries committing themselves to expanded public expenditure in a coordinated way, which lifted the world market for an unprecedented period in the 50s and 60s. And it seemed quite reasonable in this period that poor countries could aspire to raising themselves economically with the aid of countries which had something to spare. But of course, this unraveled in the, as I've said, in the 1970s for a number of reasons, and was replaced by something which still called itself development, but was not in any serious way committed to it. I mean, from the 80s onwards, what became known as the Washington Consensus was essentially committed to reducing the power of states to influence their citizens' economic conditions, and instead letting the market hold sway in a relatively unfettered way. This was also a period when the wild banking boom of the 1970s that was fueled by the oil surplus created by the formation of OPEC in the energy crisis of 1973, this led to a vast amount of bad debt in the poor countries, which meant that in the period, in the last two decades of the 20th century, the poor countries contributed more directly in real terms to the rich countries. The flow of income, if you like, from the poor to the rich was greater than at any other time in history. In other words, the period of the 80s and 90s and going on into the first decade of this century was saw a systematic income drain of unparalleled proportions. The idea of development in its original sense went out of the window under these circumstances. And development it became a kind of talk without any real consequences, I would argue. Okay, so that's the first notion of development. The second one is what's been happening in the last 200 years since the time of the Industrial Revolution, about around 1800. Around 1800, the world population was about 1 billion. And in the following two centuries, it became, as it is now, more than 6 billion. The proportion of human beings living in cities was something like 1 in 40 or 2.5% around 1800, and it's now almost a half. And finally, for at least 150 years, now what these two, let me give an annual, what this means is that population has been growing for 200 years at an average rate of 1.5%, and urbanization has been taking place at a rate of 2%. And the difference between population growth and the rate of urbanization, 0.5%, is what has created this massive growth of cities. But the rate of energy production and consumption has been growing at 3%, or twice the twice the rate of population growth for at least 150 years. But of course, this additional energy is wildly unevenly distributed. I mean, American citizens consume 200 times the energy of Ugandan citizens. This is, of course, widely known. But what I want to draw attention to is what this phenomenon, which is truly incredible, what drove it? Well, we all know what drove it. What drove it was capitalism. So the second pair of ways in which development has been used in the last 200 years by original thinkers and so on, is that on the one hand, it's an answer to the question, how did they do it? How do you make such an incredible economic expansion? What is the source of this economic growth? How can we get on the bandwagon? So that's development in that sense. How does capitalism pull it off? But the other notion of development is based on the notion that capitalism is both creative and highly destructive. And so one of the consequences of capitalist development is a large amount of social pathology. This was clear to writers like Saint-Simon from soon after the French Revolution. And so the second meaning of development in this context is how can we patch up the mess that capitalism makes? Okay, so there are two kinds of development questions. How do we get it, the growth that we want? And how the hell can we manage the mess that it makes? And these are two very different things. I would argue that development in as a political relationship since the Second World War between rich and poor countries was in the first instance a search for genuine economic growth, in the second instance a way of trying to cosmetically patch up the mess. Now there's a third notion of development which I think has become much more apparent as a result of this 200 years of population expansion, urbanization, energy growth, and so on. And this is that it becomes more and more obvious that we are in a process of making a world society in a real and palpable sense. I mean, I would go further. I would say that although globalization in some form has taken place for centuries, that the period since the Second World War has produced a kind of single social network on the planet of a kind that never existed before. I would point to three recent developments for this that accelerated this process of, if you like, globalization. One was the collapse of the Soviet Union, opening up the world as a whole to transnational capital. The second was the emergence of China and India and their 2 billion people as economic powers in their own right for the first time. And the third, of course, was the rise of the internet. So in all these ways, I would suggest that we face quite dramatically the necessity of finding ways of organizing the world society that exists and which is now, of course, pulverized by an economic crisis that was unimaginable a year ago. This is something that I write about a lot. I'm an anthropologist. I think that anthropology has, as one of its contributions to make, the exploration of what it is that humanity has in common that might allow us to make a society that works globally. So that's another sense of development that I think is urgent, and it stands in some sort of dialectical relationship to the dominant political form of the 20th century, which, of course, was the nation-state and national society. And, of course, now somebody like Maynard Keynes is evoked quite regularly for as a a source of ideas as to what to do about the economic mess we're in now. But Keynes was writing in a time when national economies were much more self-sufficient than they are now. And it seems to me extremely unlikely that we will resolve the problems that we now face by reverting to some national framework of politics. So, and I truly believe, and this is perhaps histrionic, that unless we can reorganize the principles of world society in the 21st century on a basis that is unlike that that gave us the 20th century, then there won't be a 22nd. I believe that the formation of global civil society, even of world government, is an urgent necessity for us and will require a radical break. The fourth sense in which I use the term development kicks back to before the Industrial Revolution, to the Enlightenment, and this is my principal source of inspiration these days, which is the classical liberal philosophers, Locke, Rousseau, Kant, and others, who basically pose the question of what to do about unequal society, what to do about an arbitrary and grotesquely unequal society that we call sometimes the old regime, and what can we put in its place? What we need to put in its place is a democracy, that is something in which the mass of ordinary people play a part in organizing the decisions that affect their lives. And so all of this philosophy was geared towards essentially seeking the anthropological and philosophical basis for the establishment of a society on a more equal footing and with some democratic potential against what they faced, the old regime. My fifth sense of development is revolution. I mean, what this Enlightenment philosophy fed was a series of revolutions in England, America, France, Italy, and elsewhere, which sought violently often to establish this new democracy against the unequal society in which these movements had grown up. There was also a major revolution at the same time which was forgotten for a while, the slave revolution of Haiti, in the 1790s, which also had global significance. But what I want to talk about today and emphasize is, I mean, you might say, well, what did England have? What did Britain have? Well, we had an industrial revolution. But I actually believe that Britain was the center of another revolution, which took, which lasted for the best part of a century in various peaks and troughs, and which was concerned with the abolition of slavery. The abolition movement, starting in the 18th century and culminating in the second half of the 19th century, was a genuinely international movement. It was concerned with attacking inequality at its source in racial slave-based production, mainly in the New World. And I want to, in the second part of my talk, I'll be referring to the quite surprising part that Cambridge played in the abolition movement. But in any case, we have to be aware that change of the kind that the developmental change of the kind that was launched in England and America and France and Italy, has often takes a revolutionary form. And I've already said that I believe that the leading social movement of the 20th century was the anti-colonial movement, by which I mean that after the Industrial Revolution, the Western powers took their machines and used them to control the planet, By 1900, people of European descent controlled 90% of the planetary surface. And they did so largely by turning their machines and money to purposes that allowed them a quick and easy domination of the rest of the world. This was how modern world society was created. It was created by Western imperialism. It was highly unequal and it was deeply racial. I just lost the plot then for a moment. I have to backtrack. What was happening? Okay, so I'll leave that. What was happening was what happened after that. I mean, the people in the world were brought into a very unequal form of racial domination based on superior economic means, and they spent most of the 20th century fighting for their own independent relationship to world society, which is, you know, where the great movements of liberation came from. And they were at their height in the middle of the 20th century when I was growing up. I mean development in all those ways. I mean, you take your pick. But what I want you to take from my analysis is that these notions, these definitions, are anchored in particular historical circumstances that may be of variable significance to us now. None of them have any particular a priori value. Now, the second part of my talk, I want to talk about Cambridge, what I think Cambridge is. And I want to start by talking about the history of Cambridge's social structure. In other words, I want to go back 800 years. Who were these people? They were monks who escaped from Oxford because they were fed up with what they thought had become a kind of establishment toadyism. Oxford was founded in this new spirit of universal knowledge, but some people felt that it didn't take very long for that to be squashed and people to start serving establishment interests in ways that undermined the aspiration of the foundation. And so some of them came. They actually were just outside the window here, between St. John's and Magdalen, next to the river. In fact, St. John's, the name St. John's, comes from the name of their foundation. So they set themselves here, and then some of them broke away to establish what became ultimately Peterhouse, and which is now recognized as the first college in Cambridge. Now, I think it's very important to understand this kind of original cultural recipe, if you like, for the foundation of Cambridge. What people wanted to do, like the Jesuits and others, was to discover the unity of God's plan for the world. That meant embracing universal knowledge in a new way and abandoning restrictive and narrow versions of understanding. And so the fundamental commitment is to break with unequal and established society with the aim of generating intellectual freedom that would allow us to make a new connection to the universal. The universal, of course, being closely identified with God at this time. This became the method through which Cambridge colleges expanded. Every new college was founded by a fraction of people who felt that the university had fallen back onto old ways, and they wanted to establish a new connection with the universal. So, for example, in St. John's, you had followers of the mother of Henry Tudor, Henry VII, who were mainly rural notaries, notables, who, apart from founding St. John's, founded Shrewsbury School, Manchester Grammar School, and various others. And their basic aim clearly was to found a college in which bright boys from the provinces would have a chance to break in. That was their recipe. There are other, the Puritan divines of the 17th century, the bishops and John Harvard and so on, who founded Emmanuel, had a different conception of what they were aiming to do. And all these colleges, when they were established, were all basically trying to renew what they saw as the highest mission of the university in their own particular way, coming from where they came from. And in the face of what was always the case, that Cambridge and Oxford and other institutions like them always contain a vast majority of establishment deadheads. I mean, you know, the function of the university is so easily diverted to the maintenance of inequality. And it's so much easier to pursue a career path which is based on doing what is required. And so I would argue that there is a kind of permanent tension in Cambridge, which is no greater or lesser now than it ever was before, which was that it's like Pareto's 80-20 rule. I mean, basically, 80 people at 80% deadheads, 20% maybe doing something. And and you know, for example, in 1900, if you looked at Cambridge, the two big issues were what to do about the women and whether the dons should be priests or not. And in fact, there were these Hooray Henrys tearing down the gates of Newnham in protest against the admission of women into the university. There was vast and endless angels on a pinhead type conversation about whether, you know, you could be a Cambridge Don without being a paid up practitioner in the Church of England. All of this kind of stuff. I mean, if you were doing a social history of the place, that's all you would see. I mean, just deadheads. What you wouldn't see is that Cambridge, at that time, was making modern physics. I mean, the Cavendish Laboratory had just been established by James Clerk Maxwell. Darwin's son Horace was making the machines to make the experiments work. Two northern lads, Adam Sedgwick and William Whewell, established the world's first natural science tripos. All of this thing was going on in the cracks, as Kate said, against the background in which most people coming to Cambridge were basically a waste of space. All right. The second aspect of the social structure that I want to emphasize, and this has turned out to me to be by far the most thrilling and supportive aspect of the institutional structure of Cambridge, is that it has no pronounced central hierarchy. I've taught in 12 or 14 universities around the world, four continents, and I can tell you that this is the only place that I've ever been in which the president doesn't rule the show. And the reason the president doesn't rule the show is because there are three distinct institutional spheres. There are the departments, there are the colleges, and then there are the specialist centers for like the African Studies Center or whatever. And what this means is that Cambridge has always been a network society. It's not, if you come here, it's no good trying to find a social structure to adapt to, because it isn't there. You have to make your own society here. I mean, one of the reasons why Cambridge has produced more than half of the best actors in Britain since the Second World War is because the plurality of theatrical possibilities in Cambridge means that all these people had to become their own entrepreneur in order to get in the ADC or the Footlights or Queens or whoever. In other words, there is a particular style of intellectual entrepreneurship that flourishes when the social structure is too decentralized to offer a fixed pattern for adaptation. So, in my view, this remains, but it's a precarious situation, Cambridge's greatest strength. And it's one of the reasons why, I mean, half the biggest ideas since Jesus Christ came out of Cambridge. You know, Charles Babbage, Darwin, Keynes, Rutherford, Maxwell, Newton, give him a plug. So you know, I mean, why? Well, I keep asking myself, why? Why are these people changing the world? DNA, I didn't even mention DNA, Crick Watson. You know, Crick Watson is a very good example. Crick Watson were in bad odor with their department, the Department of Molecular Biology. They couldn't get any research money and not even an office space. So they got an office space in the Cavendish Laboratory in physics. A very small office space, but it was a space. Allowed them to, you know, invent DNA or whatever they did. But I can't imagine another university where somebody who is frozen out of the biology department will get a toehold in the physics department. Can you imagine that? See, that's what that kind of flexibility, it seems to me, is deeply built into Cambridge's institutional structure. And it's why, whatever I may say, you know, to rubbish some aspects of its culture, I would emphasize this as something that we desperately need to hold on to. I mentioned that Cambridge played a very prominent role in the abolition movement. I mean, you know, the abolition was, I mean, progressives in early 19th century Britain and Cambridge based their ideas on three linked notions. One of them was the need to abolish slavery. The second was evangelical Christianity coming out of Wesley. And the third was economic individualism. And most of the practitioners, the leading lights, I mean, made some sort of combination of these three things. I mean, the Darwins and the Wedgwoods, big Cambridge families, used to boycott West Indian sugar because of slavery, and they would start their meals by offering a prayer for the slaves. This was, big stuff, and it turned out that, I mean, I've written a lecture. I published on my website a lecture that I gave here 13 years ago, something like that, called Clarkson, Cambridge, and the International Movement for Human Rights, in which I established that almost everything that we think about Cambridge is refuted by the history of this movement around 1800. Thomas Clark, the leading practitioners of the abolition movement in this country, were from Cambridge. Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce were both from this college. So was William Wordsworth, who wrote a poem praising Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the slave revolution in Haiti. The people who supported this movement cut across town and gown divisions. They were nonconformist preachers, they were high Tory churchmen, Master of Queens. There was a guy called Benjamin Flower who produced the Cambridge Intelligencer, which was the most radical magazine in Britain around 1800. And he advocated abolition by means of revolution. And this was at a time when Britain was fighting Napoleon, in the name of anti-revolution. I mean, this was dangerous stuff. And I've described it at greater length if you want to follow it up in that piece on Clarkson. The Vice Chancellor, Peter Peckard, Master of Magdalen, produced what was taken to be the most revolutionary sermon in Cambridge since the Reformation in that small church near the Market Square, St. Edward's. And he produced a slogan for his sermon, "Am I not a man and a brother?" which Josiah Wedgwood then turned into a best-selling plaque or medal or whatever. This is quite extraordinary, but what is most extraordinary of all is that the Aminong's grease of this movement was William Pitt, the Tory Prime Minister, who was Cambridge's MP, who was only 23 or something like that when he was Prime Minister. And he could not be directly involved in the abolition movement because he's a Tory, but William Wilberforce was his best friend, and he set him up to do that. And the mayor of Cambridge, who lived in the house that is now Barclays Bank in Bennett Street, Mortlock, was also, he was the placeman of the Duke of Northumberland. All of these people were involved in an extraordinary attempt to shift the balance of Britain's economic interest from the Caribbean, from slave-based sugar, west, east to India and northeast to the Baltic. So this is a period that is almost unknown, but it also speaks of a Cambridge which is very hard for us to recognize in terms of conventional descriptions of the place. What else did Cambridge contribute to development in the 19th century? The main contribution, and some people can sneer at this, but I don't, was evangelical mission activity. Cambridge was a hotbed for evangelical Christianity and mission activity. There was a young scholar from St. John's called Henry Martin, who not only was a leading light of this movement, but he was a pioneer in the organization of Indian languages as objects of study. I could say some more about this, but I'm running out of time. But the fact is that you should look very carefully at these 19th century Christians who came out of Cambridge and did what they did, often against a lot of imperialist contradiction in the places that they operated. And I think that these people have a lot that may be similar with you. That's one of the things I think, is that if we could get out of just rubbishing the fact that they were evangelical Christians, we might see that what motivated them and the social consequences of their work was a major contribution to development in the context of Western imperialist expansion in the 19th century. But really, I mean, what Cambridge contributed in the 19th century was science, as I've already indicated. Cambridge, in case you've forgotten or in case it's become obscured, it's a science university. And that's the big difference from Oxford. Most of the people in, you know, who count in this university are doing natural science of one kind or another. And the 19th century was a period when Cambridge, as I've said, produced revolutionary changes in biological and physical science, which continued into the first half and even later in the 20th century, the atom and DNA and so on. And let us not forget that Cambridge also produced the greatest economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, probably, in my mind, the only defensible economist of the 20th century, and certainly someone from whom we still have a lot to learn. I mean, he was amazing. He also ran the Arts Theatre as a sideline and was bursar at King's, made them rich. They were poor before he took them over. So I don't want to get carried away with with emphasizing only what it is that people from Cambridge did, as it were, in the rest of the world, such as the missionaries, or through working for abolition. This was very important. But it's worth remembering that inventing modern physics had a major effect on global development in the 20th century. Okay, and I guess that leads me as a bridge to my final section to the question of what Cambridge is like now. Now, I mean, Kate was really smart. Well, I knew she was smart already, but she basically said, look here, son, you left here 12 years ago, so don't tell us what this place now is, because it's changed a lot, which I'm sure it has. But I believe that what we're faced with at the moment is a situation in which the syllabus is basically antiquated. It's too specialized and divided, and it's very hard to adapt it to the needs of thinking big about questions of development. I mean, Cambridge has played a minor role, as you know, in training colonial administrators and development administrators, but it really is a minor role compared with all the other things that have been going on. And I think to a large extent, the development of the academic division of labor since the Second World War, and in particular, the shift in emphasis from teaching to research, has led to a fragmentation of intellectual effort that represents a major obstacle at this stage of Cambridge's is going to create new intellectual syntheses. But it remains the case, I believe, that this is a time when we can make another break. We can look at what's going on, and we can say that most people basically are essentially supporting an unequal status quo and not doing much to change it for the better. But nevertheless, it is possible, given the traditions of this place, for some handful and networks of small groups of people to decide to take it in their hands to do something new. And there is every chance to do this, because Cambridge has become a kind of global factory for graduate students and postdocs, which brings people in from everywhere in the world, throws them together in groups such as this, and creates, I think, all the possibilities for renewing Cambridge's established tradition in a new way. Okay, so to sum up my basic theme, what Cambridge specializes in is self-organized networks which are capable of breaking with established tradition and making a new connection to the universal. And that this becomes a matter of great urgency at a time where humanity has slipped into making a world society that it doesn't know how to handle and suffers from problems which are too many even to begin to try and list. I think that the principal obstacle to this process of making a break, renewing connection with the universal, is two things. One is the continuing place of Cambridge as a means of reproducing national privilege, especially at the undergraduate level. There's too much emphasis on Cambridge students at the undergraduate level being drawn from Britain and channeled somehow into a faltering national elite. And the second principle that, I mean, we live in a time in which centralized hierarchy has never been stronger in Cambridge. This is mainly because of the reliance of the university on national government funding. But it's also the case that much that has taken place in British society over the last few decades has involved a kind of bureaucratic centralization, and Cambridge is not immune to that. So it seems to me that if there is this institutional possibility of self-organized networks doing new things, it has to struggle now, I think, with forces of centralization and with the legacy of being a kind of agent of national privilege that's how I would identify the sociological problem. I think we do have, especially at the graduate level and young researchers, a global population that often doesn't know itself particularly as that, that often is made to feel marginal in a college system that is still organized to, in the main part, to support the interests of British undergraduates, which is, after all, their historical role. But nevertheless, I believe that that Cambridge's ability to draw on the best intellectual talent around the world and put them in one place within the institutional framework that I've alluded to does represent a still, I think, largely untapped political and intellectual resource for the place. To go back to the basic theme, then, is that we live in an unequal society. Development is the attempt to break from it. Democracy, government by the people, for the people, and so on, has as its antithesis inequality. You can't have a democratic society in which some people have no power at all. No spending power, no political power. And we're talking about a world society in which the inequalities are massive. So the first point is that we live in a society, whatever our aspirations, that is tremendously unequal, and over the last 30 years became more unequal, not just internationally, but at every level within national societies. The piling up of wealth in a few hands produced an increase in inequality, so much so that it felt as if the nearest decade to what we were experiencing was none of them in the 20th century, but the Gilded Age of the 1890s, which was the last time when finance capital ran the show and produced this kind of inequality. So my first point is that we may like to think that the world society we live in is not a racial order, but it is still. And the symbol of that racial order is Africa, which, apart from being the poorest region on the planet, is also locked into the bottom role in a racial hierarchy. And so the first thing that we have to do, if we are serious about global development, is to tackle the remaining manifestations of this racial order. And we have a good chance to do so for two reasons. One is that the shift in economic power from the West to Asia, which has been building for some time, even under present circumstances, is continuing, breaks up a certain vision of the world that was built through and by the North Atlantic. In other words, America and Europe built up a particular vision of the world through their dominance of it. And I'm sure, and my value as a prophet is something I wouldn't bet on if I were you, but I believe that in this economic crisis, the permanent and major loser of all the world's regions is going to be Europe. And I think the crisis, as it affects Europe, is not yet even widely known. But it involves, amongst other things, the collapse of manufacturing employment and the exposure to dodgy loans in Eastern Central Europe, which will destroy the European banks just as reliably as Wall Street was destroyed by subprime. So my second point is that there is this historical shift taking place, which is by no means certain in its outcome, but it for the first time, capital has become globalized, and the epicenter of global economy is shifting back to where it once was, which is in Asia. And this means that historical society is more fluid than at many times for a long time. And secondly, that the economic crisis that I don't have to tell you about clearly represents a major opportunity for us to devise new solutions to the problems that we encounter, which in my belief we have not yet fully grasped, which I think, there are some people I know who believe we're in for 10 years of it. But in any case, intellectuals can always flourish on the basis of other people's misery. And I do believe that we face now an opportunity for radical intellectual and political action that is the greatest and most open for a generation. And it's in that context that I will conclude by saying that I don't have any recipes for how you're going to make your impact on international development, based in Cambridge as you are, but I would simply ask you to look around you and say, who's the 80%, who's the 20%, and which one do I want to belong to?
On behalf of the committee, thank you, the audience, for coming this evening. Could I thank the contributors to the magazine and those who contributed to the exhibition? Can I thank St. John's for hosting us and the 800th anniversary fund, which made some of this possible? And finally, I'm going to invite you to thank Keith Hart for giving us so much to think about. We may not agree with all of it. I wish he'd mentioned the education of women, which is high on my agenda, as one of the things that might help with a number of these problems in the developing world. But above all, I should thank him for his erudition, for pointing out to you the nature of the beast in which you live. And if you want to come and talk to me afterwards about how you mobilize against the center of the university, I can tell you. Thank you very much, Keith.